Blog Talk Radio.
Gonna tell you a little bedtime tale, legend it will become. Burgers flying out the door, sail on. 2-for-1, no concern for the future. Living for today. Fast food bite on your way, lay it all to waste. The masses are afflicted now. Moo, mad cow, mad cow, mad cow, mad cow, line dance song.
Hey, Sun Guy Nation, it's QT and Sun Guy back with you here on another Friday afternoon. We have a huge guest lined up for you today, but before we jump into things, let's go over some show notes. So if you are looking for some pro wrestling today, you will know where to go. Tonight, WCWO at the Outlaw Arena in Indianapolis, Indiana. You also have 3-2-1 Battle up here in our neck of the woods in Seattle. NWA in Santa Maria, California. VWE in Imperial, California. PWA Connecticut in Cheshire, Connecticut. APW in Royston, Georgia. New Wave Pro in Terre Haute, Indiana, and the NWA in Franklin, Kentucky. Tomorrow, PWF in Port Orchard, Washington, where you can find myself. All-Star Wrestling up in Vancouver, B.C. NGW in Crawfordsville, Indiana. PWR in San Francisco, California. EOW in Homosa, Florida. PWE in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. VWF in New Eagle, Pennsylvania. Lucha Libre Volcanica in Seattle, Washington. The NWA in Amarillo, Texas. RSWF in Memphis, Tennessee. PWE in Presque Isle, Maine. PWB in Joliet, Illinois, and BOA Pro Wrestling happening tomorrow night in Portland, Oregon. So QT, lots going on, especially up here in our neck of the woods.
Lots going on, Sunday, and I am going to try to make that match in Port Townsend, Port Orchard. Yes. Yeah, well, you know, Port Orchard and Port Townsend are twin sister cities. A lot of people didn't know this.
Well, if you went to Port Townsend, you would not find the wrestling, though.
That's true, yes. Yes. I would. There are, true to the rumors, out of Shelton, Washington, that there's kind of like a Shell Oil Lucas Stadium wannabe in Port Townsend. That's what I've heard.
Possibly, but you want to be at the Eagles Lodge tomorrow night in Port Orchard for the return of PWF featuring the big grudge match, Randy the Pimp Taylor and Bruiser Joe.
Oh, now Randy the Pimp Taylor, he's one of my favorites. But my question is, are the Pimpettes going to be there? Yes.
That I do not know. But QT, I believe it is time we gave a phone call to our guest today. What say you, we give the phone call and get Ron Fuller on here?
Oh, okay. Now, he is known as a Tennessee stud. Yes.
Yes, he was. All right. I will dial him and we will get him on with us.
Hello?
Hello, Mr. Fuller. It is Sign Guy and QT Vokes at Turnbuckle Turmoil Radio. We want to thank you for joining us, and it's an honor to have you on our program here today.
Well, thank you very much. Hey, a couple questions. We're not on the air yet, I guess, right?
We have just gone on the air.
Okay. All right. Cool. Yes. I'm glad to be a part of your show today.
Well, we usually ask the guest their first time on our program this question to start, and I know you are from a very famous wrestling family, but what led to you personally getting into the pro wrestling business?
Well, I was born and bred for it. My granddad started wrestling in 1920. My dad wrestled, and my granddad was a promoter. My dad was a wrestler and a promoter, and I followed in their footsteps. I was a wrestler and a promoter, and I come from the biggest wrestling family in the world. We got 24 people that have wrestled in from my family over the last just about 100 years now. So we've been around it all our lives, and I grew up with it. I played basketball at Miami, University of Miami, and had an opportunity to play pro ball, and I decided to be a wrestler instead. It's kind of what I was born and raised for, I feel like, and I never really considered doing anything other than wrestling.
In your career, you were quite often a number one contender for the NWA world title. The NWA is still around in some form here today, but of course it has a very long lineage and is one of the most respected promotions and conglomerate of promotions anywhere in the world. What was it like whenever you got the opportunity to wrestle for the NWA World Heavyweight title?
Oh, it was quite an honor, obviously. I ended up wrestling against probably as many as 15 world champions. Not all of them were world champion when I wrestled them, but I've wrestled as far back as Luthez was one of the best NWA world champions of all time. And I've wrestled Pat O'Connor and Gene Koninsky and both of the Funks, Jack Briscoe, Harley Race, Ric Flair, just about all of them that within between the 60s and the 80s, I probably wrestled them at least once, and some of them a few more times than once.
Now, I know that you had a very long and storied and very successful singles career, but you are also a tag team wrestler. You tag team with your brother quite often, as a brother tag team, in fact. Did you personally have a preference from singles to tag team wrestling?
I really preferred singles, but my brother and I began wrestling in 1970, and we both started as tag team wrestlers. It's a lot easier to break into the sport and have success as a tag combination than it is as a singles competitor. And we started in Georgia in 1970, and we wrestled the likes of the Assassins and some really great teams back in the early days. We won the Georgia Tag Championship. We won the Florida Tag Championship. We've been Southeastern Tag Champions, Continental Tag Champions. We have, we had a great deal of success as partners, but I really preferred the single matches because after a while, it's sometimes difficult to keep both guys healthy. And if you're in a tag situation where you're wrestling tags every night, and you get one partner that's down and out, it's pretty difficult for you to maintain any momentum. So I really preferred the wrestling as a single most of the time.
Speaking of injuries, anyone that wrestles for any length of time is going to come across the occasional injury. I know for as long as you were in the sport, you probably had several injuries over your career. What were some of the more significant injuries that you had to overcome to keep in the ring?
I had three knee operations on the right knee, all of them on the same knee. I've had a fifth lumbar, and my spine has been out since the late 60s. I've had neck injuries that have kept me out for short periods of time. I broke my collarbone. I actually drove my collarbone out of the sternum way back in the 70s, right before World Championship match. So I've had many, many injuries, like most wrestlers, but not so many that I'm crippled. I mean, I'm not in a wheelchair, and I see a lot of guys today when I go to reunions that are in a lot worse shape than I am. I feel really lucky by being able to still get around and do pretty much what I want to. I still work out, and I still enjoy my life, and I'm very blessed to be in the condition I'm in.
I'm sure at some point in time you were at a wrestling event and witnessed an injury that looked really scary. What would you say is the scariest injury that you ever saw to another wrestler?
Oh, I have seen guys break their necks. I've seen in riots guys get hurt by the fans themselves with chairs and knives. I've been cut myself in matches and with knives, and been hit in the head with chairs from behind. And you know, sometimes the worst injuries come from the fans, that matches get out of control and people are dangerous at sometimes. And I have seen probably all types of different injuries. My dad was cut one time in a match outside the ring, 75 stitches. I've seen lots of different types of things over the years, and it's a dangerous sport, and people get hurt, and anybody that thinks they don't are really, really way off base, because wrestlers suffer a lot of injuries.
You mentioned some of the places that you've wrestled as far as the United States go, but you also wrestled up in Canada. You've been to Japan, several international tours. Did you notice much of a difference as far as the crowds when you would go to different countries, as far as what they enjoyed when watching wrestling, how they behaved, things like that?
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. I've actually been to Australia. I've wrestled in most of the islands in the Caribbean. I used to go to the Bahamas in the early 70s, and it was one of the most unique places I ever wrestled. The crowd would remind me of being in a Batman movie, where they used to go the old bist and boom, and they'd write the little, you know, the thing in the cartoons. And I think they even did that on that television show when the Batman TV show was on. But the crowds would actually make sounds. It's like someone held up a placard, and then it's time for everybody to go bist, and then the next time it'd be boom, and the next time it'd be bah, it'd be whatever. I mean, it was in Japan, they're quiet, extremely quiet. You can be in, I've wrestled in Tokyo, in the sumo hall, 24,000 people sitting on the floor on their knees with their legs crossed. So, and unless you did something really spectacular, or someone got hurt or looked like they got hurt, you wouldn't hardly get anything from the Japanese people, which made it very difficult. If you're accustomed to big American crowds and very lively people and loud and very much into the event, when you go to Japan, it's quite a different game there. Although when you're in Japan, the matches are probably more difficult, and the style of wrestling there is more solid, I would say, than what you encountered in the United States. Canadian fans are like Americans. So they're pretty much similar to us. I've wrestled in Mexico, and they've got some really rabid fans in Mexico, and lots of mask guys. The mask are very, very big there. And so I've traveled lots of different places. I have seen all kinds of different things in other countries. Puerto Rico. I was in Huron B. Thorne, a baseball stadium there that we used to wrestle in the early 70s, and witnessed a riot in which probably, I'd say, 15,000 people were on the field, on the baseball field. And, you know, I've seen pretty much a lot of different types of things happen over the years. And, you know, everywhere you go is a little different. In Australia, it was similar to the United States. There you wrestled with a lot of different guys from all over the world. I was there in 73 for 3 months, and I wrestled with Mario Milano from Italy and Spiros Arion from Greece and Sabu Singh from India. There was a New Zealander in the group. There were two Japanese in the group. I mean, in some parts of the world, you go there and you wrestle with a lot of different style wrestlers, and I found that to be really helpful for me to leave the country and to go to these foreign countries and to be able to wrestle guys from different parts of the world. And you'd go back home with a different outlook, and you learn a lot from competing with guys that are from other countries and different, totally different styles most of the time.
When you would go to one of the foreign tours, did it take much time for the people that were on the tour to adapt to wrestling the style that the fans wanted to see there, or was it a little bit of a seamless transition? Once you got there, you could understand what that crowd was wanting to see when you got there?
I never really changed my styles, and I don't think a lot of wrestlers do. It's pretty difficult. In Japan, you really didn't know what the fans wanted because you never got much reaction, so it was difficult to change your style or to do something that they wanted to see because you really didn't know what they wanted to see. And then, like I was saying, if you wrestle guys from different countries, you picked up a lot of things. When I was in Australia in 73, I was just becoming good. I was becoming a star, and I picked up a lot of experience, and I picked up a lot of moves in Australia and came back to the United States, and that kind of catapulted me into one of the top wrestlers in the country and got me a lot of shots against NWA champions. And I spent a lot of time in St. Louis in the early 70s after that Australian tour. And so it really helped me to experience these different styles. But, you know, most guys, they after a while, you do what you do. And, you know, you don't go and change what you do when you go to another country. You try to make them enjoy what you do. And I usually had success at that.
Now, you were one of the tallest wrestlers in the business when you were active. You were very, very tall compared to most of the other wrestlers. In your career, what would you say was the biggest size difference for a match that you had?
You mean the difference between my height and the guy I was wrestling, or is that what you're talking about?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I've wrestled some very short wrestlers, I've wrestled Greg Peterson was a star back in the 50s and 60s. He was probably, I'd say, not much over 5 feet, 5'2", maybe 5'3". So I've wrestled small guys, and I've wrestled Andre and Hogan. And a lot of guys that are my height. So, you know, you come up against all different kinds. I mean, height is a real advantage. I always considered it to be a real advantage to be 6'9". And it helped me to, I always tried to, when I was training to learn to wrestle, I wanted to learn to do everything that a small guy could do. And that height advantage is really, really good for you. for the leverage part of the sport, and for the strength part of the sport, there's a lot of benefits to being tall. And I always try to learn the moves that worked for me, and they were a lot different than moves that worked for smaller guys. And I could do things that smaller guys couldn't do. And I had some moves that I did that no one else ever did. So, I developed my own style, and a lot of it was based upon my height.
One of the most famous wrestlers from the 70s and 80s was another very tall individual, Andre the Giant. He toured around all of the territories and was constantly on the move. Did you have much opportunities to get in the ring with Andre the Giant?
Yes, I've been in the ring with Andre many, many times. Andre was a personal friend of mine. I really loved Andre. I started my first wrestling promotion in 1975 in Knoxville, Tennessee. It was called Southeastern Wrestling. And Andre came and wrestled for me a lot. He really liked visiting me. And lots of times I'd keep him in my own home and cook dinner for him and, just take care of him. And, he was really one of the most unique individuals in the sport. And I got a bunch of stories about Andre that are, Andre was a very funny guy and he had a good sense of humor. And it was really a pleasure being around Andre. He is one of, obviously, the tallest. I think he's probably the tallest wrestler I ever wrestled against. Lots of times I was in matches with Battle Royals with Andre, and a few times, a couple of times, I've been partners with Andre, and then there are times that I wrestled against Andre. So, I've had some experience wrestling with Andre, and he was one of the greatest individuals in the sport, in my opinion.
Now, Andre the Giant was someone that was very famous, not only in pro wrestling, but he was sort of a star outside of wrestling. Everybody knew who Andre the Giant was, whether or not they were a fan of pro wrestling. Would you say he was one of the first real celebrities that pro wrestling had that transcended not only the sport, but in the mainstream consciousness?
Obviously. I mean, Andre had such immense size that, anywhere he went, everybody, he turned heads everywhere because he was just so huge. But I think there's others. And you can go back into the 50s and you talk about Gorgeous George, the original Gorgeous George. Gorgeous George was a huge wrestling star, but he was recognizable to mainstream America. Every town he went in, every city he went in, he would go and have his hair done and things like that. Get around the town to be seen by a lot of different people. He's probably one of the guys, I would say, other than Andre, that had that recognizability that very few people have.
Now, one of the people that you worked with a lot in your career also, he was very, very famous for any wrestling fan, even though he never put on a pair of boots or wrestled a match. That would be the late, great Gordon Solie. He was the announcer for many of your matches. What was it like having Gordon Solie as the announcer for most of your matches?
I thought Gordon Solie was one of the best commentators in the history of the sport. When I started in 1970, I spent about the first 4 months in Georgia, and then I moved to Tampa, and I wrestled at the home of Gordon. He was from Tampa. And I was in Florida from 70 to 74, and during those 4 years, I saw Gordon every Wednesday. We did TV together. He and I, we used to go to dinner together. When I started my wrestling companies, he worked for me in my second wrestling company. I had two Southeastern wrestling companies, one in Knoxville, Tennessee, and another in Pensacola, Florida. And he did my TVs for me in Pensacola. Once I started Continental Wrestling, he did my television for me there. Gordon was a personal friend of mine. I really liked him. We spent a great deal of time together. And like I said, in my opinion, there's no better commentator than Gordon Solie.
One of the other overlooked roles in professional wrestling that is vital is that of the referee. Great referees are very instrumental in successful wrestling promotions. Being a wrestler and a promoter, I'm sure you were aware of the ones that were extremely good, even if the fans didn't always appreciate how important they were to a wrestling event. Who do you think are some of the better referees out there that may not get the recognition that they deserve?
Well, one of the best referees was a guy in Atlanta named Hebner. David Hebner, he was a great referee, referee for many years. They also had another referee there named Charlie Smith that was very good, been in it for a long time. Most territories had one or two really good referees. Florida had a guy named Stu Schwartz, who was really good, who later went to wrestle, went to referee in Mid-Atlantic for the Crockett's, and stayed there for many years. I had one at Southeastern Wrestling named McMurray that was really good in my second company in Pensacola. I had a guy named Larry Brock who was really good. And they're crucial and the critical part of wrestling. And if they're good, they can make a match better. And another one that's really good is Scott Armstrong. WWE, he wrestles a lot. I mean, he referees a lot of their WrestleManias and a lot of their big pay-per-view events. So, you know, it's he's an important guy. The third man in the ring is a really important guy. And like I say, in every part of the country, just about every territory across the world would have one or two really key referees that help them be successful.
At this point in time, my co-host QT is standing by, and I know QT has some questions, so I'm going to pass things along to him.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Sun Guy. Hello, Ron.
Hey, how are you?
Oh, I'm pretty good, pretty good. Ron, in 1979, Pro Wrestling Illustrated was first published and was actually featured in a venue you don't see much more today, the newsstand. PWI had you ranked at number 10 in the National Wrestling Alliance. Do you recall who was ranked just ahead of you at number 9?
No, I don't. I wasn't even aware of that. I recall in 73, 74, 75, I was pretty consistently in the top 10 in the NWA. I don't know who would be number 8, but, you know, and we're talking 79. It might be Flair, somebody like Ric Flair. But that's just a guess. I was lucky enough to be in the top 10 for many, many years. Once I started my own wrestling companies, I kind of dropped out of the top 10 because I quit traveling. When I was young and just beginning and trying to make a name for myself, I was moving from territory to territory and doing a lot of stuff in Australia and Japan and other countries. And I was more recognizable. And once I started my own wrestling promotions, I very rarely wrestle for anybody other than my own company. And so I kind of dropped out of those rankings because I wasn't being seen as much as I was when I was younger. Who was the number eight?
Oh, all right. Okay.
Yeah, I was just curious. I was curious. Who was the number eight?
Oh, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I mean, I know that Flair was very good back at that point, 79, you know, there were a lot of I was friends with a whole lot of guys because I used to go to the National Wrestling Alliance conventions, being a promoter every year, and lots of wrestlers would come to those conventions. And then by traveling all over the world and by going to different parts of the country and wrestling different parts of the country, especially in my early career, I met just about every big name. And if I didn't wrestle them, I at least was on cards with them and had opportunity to meet them. So it was beneficial for me, that's for sure.
Oh, wow. Well, we at Turnbuckle Turmoil are always into the weekly rankings. Huge, huge spot for us. Yes. In the Northwest ranking.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Okay. Yes, and you don't see that venue anymore, the newsstand. Never see it.
Yeah, I think all those wrestling magazines, there used to be four or five wrestling magazines back in the early 70s and up till late 70s maybe, but, you know, I think in the 80s, I don't remember hardly any of them being around anymore. I don't know what happened to all of them, but I used to have articles and stories, and, you know, I would pick up those magazines every once in a while, and I'd find myself in there, and it was like, wow, it was really, really, I was really happy to see it in my early days because I wanted that exposure, and it was always great to open a magazine and see you there in a big picture and maybe a two-page story or something. And so it was a great thing for the wrestling fans, and I can't really understand why they don't do it anymore, but then the wrestling has changed dramatically, and I guess that's a lot of it.
Well, it's all about the internet now. Yes.
Yeah.
It's all about the internet. Okay. Well, Mr. Fuller, I saw your Southeastern Championship Wrestling match on YouTube with a Mongolian Stomper and Gorgeous George Jr. Now, Gorgeous George Jr. threw a mysterious powder into the eyes of the referee at the 1:17 mark, right as you were pummeling the Mongolian Stomper against the turnbuckles. As the referee was lying helpless on the mat, you whipsawed the Gorgeous George Jr. into the ring over the top rope. You then proceeded to give two overhand rights to the forehead and then were then down on the mat on top of his chest, raining blows. While your back was turned, the Mongolian Stomper landed a right cross haymaker to the referee, who was launched 180 degrees over the top rope. My question is, do you remember the name of this ref who, as he fell, seemed to strike his lower back against the ring apron and bend Gumby cartoon style on his way to the Coliseum floor?
Geez, now I would have to. I know he was small. I know that I have seen this video, and I can't remember his name right now. It may be Tommy Weathers. He was a referee in Tennessee. I think he was from Cleveland, Tennessee, just outside Chattanooga. And he wrestled for me. He refereed for me a lot in Knoxville. And I believe it might have been Tommy Weathers that was knocked over the top rope. And those guys took some pretty nasty bumps back in the day. And they were small. And, you know, you're used to grabbing a big guy. And if you're going to shoot him through the ropes, you know, you put a lot of power behind it. And, you know, if you got your hands on a referee and you were going to do that to him, I mean, it was a lot more dangerous for a referee than it was for a wrestler to go out like that. And I'd say in all likelihood, he probably got hurt. I don't really remember whether he did or didn't, but I do remember that match. And as I remember, it ended up with the Mongolian Stomper had his boot off, and I ended up with his boot, and then he ended up loading his, he used to wear a wrestling, like a, amateur wrestling headgear, and he ended up loading something into his headgear and catching me from behind. But it was a very good match, as I remember. And the times that I've watched that, I've seen that video maybe a couple of times. And what amazes me was the crowd noise. It was probably, I guess, 10,000 plus. And the crowd noise is pretty deafening in that video. There was a lot of excitement in the buildings back in those days.
Yes, I'd encourage all our Turnbuckle Turmoil listeners to look up this YouTube match, the Southeastern Championship Wrestling match. That was one of the more, I'd say, one of the more, how would you say, when that referee went over the top rope, he actually did almost a 360-degree somersault. And, boy, he hit that ring apron pretty hard and bent, you know. And I hope he was okay, but I don't see how he could have not have gotten hurt. One of the more spectacular launchings of a referee I have ever seen on YouTube.
Yeah. And in all likelihood, he probably did get hurt. I don't remember I remember that I was pretty injured at the end of the deal. I didn't feel too good myself. I wasn't worried about the referee. I was worried about surviving it. So it was, but it did, you know, a lot of guys got hurt, and especially referees, because they were smaller and they, you know, they weren't used to taking bumps. And when they did, a lot of times they did get hurt.
Well, you know, you did mention that boot. You did strike the Mongolian Stomper with that boot, and it wasn't attached to any human foot. Gorgeous George Jr. hit you from behind at precisely the 2-minute mark of this match, or should I say he tried to hit you, but instead he fell on the Mongolian Stomper after having horizontally launching himself 2 seconds beforehand. And as you got out of the way from this horizontal launch, you couldn't help but notice that Gorgeous George tried to hit you from behind with a riding crop. My question is, do you know if Gorgeous George was raising any Kentucky Derby racing horses in the Kentucky area at that time because he had that riding crop, and was one of his horses that he would have been raising 1979 Triple Crown winner Seattle Slough?
Yes. Now that's a good one there. I had no idea. I didn't know that Gorgeous George Jr. was involved with horses, but he was wrestling in my area for probably a year, and he managed the Mongolian Stomper the entire time. He was a pretty talented wrestler before he became a manager, and when he was younger, he was pretty darn good. But I didn't know he had anything to do with horse racing, but he used to carry that crop, and every time he got a chance, he would draw your attention. Sometimes your opponent would be in front of you, and he would sneak around behind you, and he would slap you on the leg with it, or in the back with it. Just to get your attention, you could turn your attention to him. It gave the guy in the ring the opportunity to take advantage of it. And he was pretty good. Him and Stomper were pretty good about there was a lot of coordination between those two. And when you wrestled one of them, you know, you wrestle Stomper, you usually ended up having to take into account where Gorgeous George Jr. was during the entire match, because he was going to do something somewhere in the match.
Yes, well, you never really see riding crops in the ring. I thought that was pretty interesting that Gorgeous George Jr. would have a riding crop. Hence the question about Kentucky Derby winner Seattle Slough. Yes.
Right. Okay.
Well, Ron, did you ever hear or have a chance to wrestle with a man named Big Bully Busick?
No, it doesn't ring a bell with me. Where is he from?
Oh, okay. Well, Big Bully Busick is a rather large man who appeared in the wrestling ring in English Derby hats, kind of a black hat, and he had a handlebar mustache. Big handlebar mustache.
Do you know where, what area of the country you wrestled in a lot?
I think from the Midwest. If I'm correct, right, Sign Guy, Midwest.
He was out of West Virginia, but he covered quite a bit of the upper Midwest down into around Georgia.
Yes.
I don't remember him. I used to do quite a bit of wrestling in the Midwest, St. Louis a lot, Kansas City sometimes, and West Virginia. I've wrestled in West Virginia. I mean, I've wrestled in probably 40, 45 states. And, Hawaii, I've even been to Hawaii several times and on the way to Japan or Australia or wherever. So I've been around a lot. But I don't recognize that name. I'd probably recognize him if I saw him.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to give you the Turnbuckle Turmoil homework assignment to look up this wrestler, Big Bully Busick. Very interesting character. Yes.
Okay. I'll take a shot at that.
I think you'll be pretty amazed at his mustache and his English derby. Very interesting. Okay. All right. Well, Ron, I also saw on YouTube a match where you were in the ring with a wrestler named Rufus Jones. In fact, the name of this YouTube video is entitled 70s Wrestling Rufus Jones versus Ron Fuller. The announcer said that Rufus was from Kansas City, Missouri, and was formerly from Dillon, South Carolina. My question is, what state usually has the best barbecue ribs and barbecued pulled pork brisket, Texas or Missouri?
I don't know. I'm going to say Missouri. I really like the barbecue in Missouri. I've been to a lot of cities in Texas, wrestled quite a bit in Texas, but I really like St. Louis has got some really good ribs and some good barbecue as well. I used to wrestle in St. Louis 73, 74 for probably 2 years, every other Friday night for 2 years, I'd say, in St. Louis, and spent a lot of time there. That was the home, basically, of the National Wrestling Alliance. Sam Muchnick was the president of the NWA for probably 30 years, and that was his city. And he liked me, and he put me on a lot of cards, and I think Sam would have liked for me to have been world champion someday, and I would have liked that too, but it just never got it done when I really needed to.
Have you yourself ever considered producing your own line of barbecue sauce named Ron Fuller's Barbecue Blast Sauce?
No. No, I haven't. Heck, I can't cook, so I couldn't. I don't know why I could produce myself any type of good barbecue sauce. If I was a cook, though, I sure like barbecues, and I think sauce is a big part of it. But I've never really considered having my own sauce named after me. I'd probably go for something different than sauce if I were going to do something like that.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, Ron, the announcer said both of you were, quote, big fellers. Ron Fuller goes 6'9", 255 out of Florida. Rufus R. tipping in at better than 265, giving away some height to Ron, but he has the weight advantage over Fuller. That's what the announcer said. My question is, would you agree that Rufus Jones had a similar build to Houston Oiler running back Earl Campbell, but was smaller in the thigh area because Campbell had 34-inch thighs?
I'd say there's a great similarity in those two bodies. Rufus was a really good wrestler, and that match you're talking about came from Memphis, Tennessee, back probably, I'm going to guess, 1975, 74, 75. And Rufus was a good opponent. He had good skills, and he had a very unique style. And it made him difficult to wrestle because his style was really different than most guys. But yeah, I'd say his legs obviously are probably smaller than the gentleman you mentioned, because, you know, being a football player, you really have to develop great legs to get it done in that sport.
Yes. And Earl Campbell, 34-inch thighs, yes. About as big as some people's stomachs, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Ron, right before the 3-minute and 34-second mark of the match, Rufus was down on his knees and took 5 straight right hands to the head, but they didn't seem to have too much effect other than the fact that his vertical base was taken away. And after that 5th punch, you kind of shook your hand. You then slammed his head into the turnbuckle at the 3-minute and 34-second mark, but he came up grinning like a Nile crocodile having captured a wildebeest. He seemed to be revitalized after this turnbuckle treatment. Question is, did he remind you of Jimmy Snuka and the tag team members of the Samoan wrestlers Haku and Tama, the Islanders, for their known hard-headedness?
Yes, he had a very hard head. He certainly did. Snuka, I've wrestled Snuka before, and I've also wrestled the Islanders. So I'm familiar with all those guys, and some people just seem to have a thicker skull than others. And you know, I don't remember that particular match, but I do remember that I did hurt my hand hitting him in the head, and the turnbuckle certainly didn't stop him. You know, that was probably less of a blow than my hand was, so. I probably should have been attacking his leg or attacking a body part rather than focusing on his head, because he really did have a hard head. And there were a lot of guys I can remember in the day that really did have, when you hit them, you know, occasionally I'd hurt my hand hitting guys. And you remember those guys that have a hard head, and you don't stay on that body part if you can't knock him down, and if you're getting nowhere with a punch, it is time to go to wrestling. It's back to doing something that you can take him down and control him in a different way. But Rufus was a good wrestler. I remember wrestling him several times.
Wow, okay. So that handshake in that video was legitimate. Okay, all right. Oh, all right, well, Ron, you secured the victory over Rufus by a pile driver outside the ring. But somehow, when you watch the video, it went blank at this moment and did not show the pile driver. The screen on the YouTube video goes blank. Do you remember, or can you tell our podcast friends who are not able to see this pile driver on YouTube, how the action got to be outside the ring?
I think we were inside the ring and out of the ring a lot during that match. And I remember toward the end of the match, I had the opportunity. I got him on the floor, and somehow I managed to get his head down there between my legs, and, you know, I took that opportunity. I mean, he had a really hard head, but it wasn't as hard as that concrete. So, you know, that was about the only way I could see to take him out was to maybe put his head on something harder than my fist or the turnbuckle, and that concrete's sure the place to put it. So I think that's what happened. I probably piledrived him right out there head first in that concrete, and I don't think he got up after that.
No, he didn't. No. In fact, you helped the referee count to 10. Yes. Okay. All right. Well, Ron, are there any truths to the rumors out of Shelton, Washington, that you got the name Tennessee Stud by winning a high-stakes poker hand of 5-card stud on a Louisiana riverboat?
Yeah, that's a good one. No, I don't think there's any truth to that. I'll tell you how I got the name Tennessee Stud. When I was wrestling in Florida in 1974, and I, I started my first wrestling promotion in Knoxville, Tennessee. I wanted to create myself an image that no one else had, and I went to Tennessee. I'd always been a good clean wrestler, and I decided that I was going to go into Tennessee as a bad guy, and I wanted to rile the fans as much as I could, and I came up with I heard a song when I was traveling one day. And it was an old song called The Tennessee Stud. And I listened to the words of the song, and I changed the words around a little bit to fit me as an individual. And the words were, he's got the brawn and he's got the blood. Well, I just changed that to, I got the brawn and I got the blood, and there ain't never been a man like the Tennessee Stud. And it just kind of took off for me. I created it. It really set me apart from a lot of other wrestlers, and it gave me an identity that no one else had, and the name seemed to be, it was a good fit for me. I was born in Tennessee, actually, so I was born there and spent a lot of time there, and I happened to be in Knoxville at that point, and wrestling a lot in Memphis, Nashville, and other parts of Tennessee, and that name just really catapulted me above most of the talent there, and gave me it built a quick reputation from that name.
Wow, now speaking of music, are there any truth to the rumors that you had background vocal duties on the song Bad Street USA that was composed by Fabulous Freebird, Michael PSAs?
No, I didn't. No, I don't have a very good voice. So, no, I've never done any background, but I can imagine Michael Hayes singing that song. You know, I mean, Michael Hayes believed he could have been a rock star of some kind. He thought he was a rock star. And I know Michael Hayes very well, wrestled him many times, too. And him and the Free Birds, Terry Gordy and the whole group, Roberts, all of them. I've was familiar with all those boys. And they were a talented group. The three of those guys were very talented.
Oh, okay. All right. No, I'm going to mark down no background vocal duties, okay, in my logbook. Okay.
Yeah, good.
All right. Well, Ron, in the opening moments of the show with Sign Guy, you mentioned that you played basketball at the University of Miami. I'm going to guess you were a power forward.
Well, I actually played center. I was there in the late 60s. I went my freshman year to Clemson in South Carolina, and then I transferred to University of Miami and finished at the University of Miami. And enjoyed my basketball days, but like I was saying earlier, I never really considered doing anything but wrestling. Once I got finished with my basketball, and I was ready to go and do what I'd prepared for most of my life. When we were growing up, my dad had a wrestling ring in the backyard for me and my brother Robert. And we worked out, you know, instead of being shooting basketball, he would find me shooting basketball, and he would say, "Boy, put that ball down and get over here to the ring." So I kind of got pushed in the direction of wrestling all my life, and luckily I turned out to be pretty big, and I had the height, and I had an unusual look, I guess, and it really helped me to make a name for myself. Actually, back in those days, I was probably making more money than most NBA players. It was a lot different than it is nowadays. There was, back in the late 60s, there wasn't a lot of money being made playing basketball.
Did you have any offers from the ABA, Kentucky Colonels?
No, not the Colonels, but I could have gone into the draft in 1970, and they contacted me, and I told them I was going to go do something else, and I started wrestling in that same year. As soon as I finished college that year, I started. 2 weeks later, I was in the ring. And I'd already wrestled some, even during my college career, which was illegal at that point. You know, I was being paid, and I was I would put on masks and wrestle around different places in the country. And I was less than 21 years old, and I would try to hide my identity so that I did not hurt my career in basketball, didn't lose my scholarship in Miami. But I was already doing some wrestling even when I was in college. And, you know, as soon as I finished my last year in college, the way started right away in the ring.
Wow, fantastic. All right. Well, at this point, I'm going to turn it back over to Sign Guy, and I wish you luck with your homework assignment to look up Big Bully Busick.
Okay. Nice talking to you.
All right. Back to you, Sign Guy. Yes.
Thank you, QT. Well, Mr. Fuller, we have just a few minutes left in the show, so I want to give you time. If there's anything that you would like to say to our listeners today, if you want to plug or promote absolutely anything in the world at all, floor is all yours.
Well, you know, I appreciate you guys contacting me. It's been my pleasure to be on the program today. I haven't done many of these podcasts, and it's nice to be able to talk to people about the business. And, you know, we as wrestlers are in a unique sport. It's kind of like equated to being an American cowboy. I mean, you know, wrestlers are just like cowboys. I mean, they like to ride wild horses, and we're a wild group. And I missed that part of it. I missed that part of my life. And it was a great time I had over the years as a wrestler. And it's always great to go back and reminisce. And you guys have brought up some matches and things that I hadn't thought about in a long time. And it's been a real pleasure just to be on the program. And I sure have enjoyed it. And thank you very much for inviting me.
It was absolutely our pleasure to have you. We were thrilled to have you on our program. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us. Fans, if you're not familiar with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, you definitely need to do your research, do your homework. He was an absolutely phenomenal performer. His family is legendary. You should research his entire family. Get familiar with him if you're a wrestling fan. We will be back with you on Sunday afternoon. We have the NWA Pacific Northwest Ladies Champion, Miss Sunny Days, is our guest on Sunday. Should be an outstanding time with her. Get out there, support your local wrestling wherever it may be. You can find me at Port Orchard, Washington tomorrow night for PWF. Hopefully we'll see a lot of you there, and we will talk to you on Sunday.